more. She said even though I threw away her things, she was going to give me something new. I believed her. I felt bad. She said the new gift was already under my coat bed. I looked. It was a rat bone. She liked to goad me into chasing her. Whether I did or not, she always ran. If I didn't chase her, she would stop and thumb her nose at me and call me fishy-mishy. I didn't have to be goaded the time she leaned out of the window above me and dropped a raw turnip on my head. I picked the turnip out of the dirt, put it in my pocket, and took off after her. When I caught her, I shook her and told her never to treat food that way. All she did was laugh. So I rubbed the dirty turnip in her face and shook her harder. And the harder I shook, the louder she laughed. I became so used to her noise, chattering, whining, pestering, laughing, crying, that my ear went on hearing it even when it stopped. All during one particular day, I sensed that something was wrong, but I didn't know what. I didn't know it was the absence of Janina. I barely heard her all day, barely saw her. That night, as usual, most activity came to a stop. The light bulb was always dark now. The end of the day's light was the end of ours. No more knocks on the door for Mr. Milgram's pills and potions. Uncle Shepsel put away his book on how to become a Lutheran. Mrs. Milgram did not have to stop whatever she was doing, for she did nothing to begin with. All day, all night, she lay on the mattress with her back to us. She moved only when she coughed. Usually, Janina continued to play pick-up sticks in the dark, by fingertip feel, until her father said, "Janina!" And she would stop and lie down on the overcoat next to me. But on this night, she was already on her coat when I lay down. I slept with my new family almost every night now. Mr. Milgram always said goodnight to us, first to Janina, then to me. I always looked forward to that moment, as no one had ever said goodnight to me before. On this night, when he said, "Good night, Janina," there was no answer. As usual, I waited until I heard everyone sleeping. It pleased me to do this. I liked to pretend that if anyone heard me go out, I would be forbidden. I got up and crept from the room. I did this nearly every night. I tiptoed down the stairs and into the moonlit courtyard and into the street. My instinct was to be bold and uncatchable, but I enjoyed being sneaky too. The streets looked deserted, but I knew they were not as deserted as they appeared. I knew that somewhere along the wall, Big Henrik stood as tall as he could with Kuba on his shoulders, and Kuba was draping two thick coats across the barbed wire and hauling himself over and down to the other side, then tossing over the wall the rope that Big Henrik would winch him back with. I knew that beneath my feet, in the sewers where daylight never fell on the rats and the rivers of poop, Enos and Ferdy and one-armed Oleg were creeping toward the wall, puffing on Ferdy cigars to give themselves points of light and to smoke over the stink. I knew they all wished they could come with me. They wished they could fit through the two-brick space. As for Uri, who knew? He was somewhere, doing something. I darted from shadow to shadow until I was across the street from the wall. I stood in the shadow of a doorway. The night glowed beyond the barbed wire. Sounds floated over, a clink, a tinkle, a voice, a wisp of music. I leaned out to watch for flops on patrol. Someone was standing in the moonlight, an arm's length away. I couldn't believe it. Janina! I followed you. She was grinning. I yanked her into the doorway. "Go back," I said. "No! Go back! I'm going with you." Her eyes were two drops of moonlight. "You're not little enough," I said stupidly. "I'm littler than you. I'm not taking you. You have to. You're my big brother." That stopped me for a moment and gave me all the more reason not to allow her. "No." "Yes." I smacked her in the face. The moon drops wobbled. She smacked me back. And that was that. I dashed across the street to the wall, and in a moment I was through the two-brick space and onto the other side. A moment later, she came squirting through the hole. 26. She stood gaping.
The rest of the city. It's still here.
I ran to her. I pulled the armband from her sleeve and stuffed it into her coat pocket. I did the same with my own.
See? You made me forget.
I stomped off. It was not good to be seen near the wall. I took the sidewalks. I heard her footsteps behind me. I walked fast. Maybe I couldn't stop her from following me, but I had no intention of making her a full partner. Soon, we were among the people, the source of the voices and sounds that came drifting over the wall. In the ghetto, all was gray. The people were gray. The sounds were gray. The smells were gray. Here, everything was colors to me. The red clang of the streetcars, blue music from phonographs, silver laughter of people. In the distance, the tootles of the merry-go-round were a swirl of colors. Whenever I came through the wall, I wanted to do nothing but walk the streets.
I remembered Uri's words. Don't look guilty. I swaggered down the sidewalk. I headed straight for other pedestrians and made them veer around me. I whistled. In other words, I ignored Uri's other commands. Don't call attention to yourself. Be invisible. Or maybe I heeded a little. I resisted the temptation to put the blue and white band back on my arm. I was proud to be part of the Milgram family, proud to be a Jew. I wanted to wave my armband and shout, "Hey, everyone, look at me! I'm a Jew! A filthy son of Abraham!" But I didn't. I heard Janina whistling behind me. I went to my favorite place. It was a hotel for jackboots. Jackboots ate there and drank beer and slept there. A blue neon sign in the shape of a camel blinked off and on above a revolving door. I did what I always did. I went in the revolving door and around and right back outside again. Janina did it too, but she didn't stop after once around. I jerked her away. I went around back. Garbage cans as tall as me were lined up like soldiers. As usual, the lids were off, and several children were poking through the stench and maggots. They were too busy to notice me. The hatch door leading to the food cellar was locked, as usual. There were several windows at ground level. There were steel bars in front of the glass. I knelt before one of the windows. I pushed it open. I took off my coat and tossed it inside. I turned myself sideways and squeezed between two of the bars and dropped head first into the dimly lit cellar. I thought nothing of it. I lived in the cracks of a world made for large, slow people. As I was bending over for my coat, Janina's coat hit me in the rump. She came tumbling down in a flurry of underwear. "Ow!" she squawked. "Be quiet," I told her. "You should have stayed home." I pulled the sack from my pocket and unfolded it. "What's that for?" she said. "Food," I said. "I don't have one." "Too bad." "Where's the pickled eggs?" "They don't have any." Not that I would have known a pickled egg if I saw one. She swept a large coffee can from a shelf. It crashed to the floor. I balled my fist in front of her face. "Stop it! They're going to hear." She jabbed her chin at me. "I don't like you. I don't like you." "Good," she said, and stomped off among the shelves, searching for pickled eggs. I began making my rounds. There was one problem with the Blue Camel Hotel food cellar. Much of the food was in cans and jars, too big and heavy to carry a long way, so I concentrated on smaller, lighter things. There were wooden bins of onions and lettuces and turnips and cabbages. There were boxes of soda crackers and stacked loaves of brown and black bread. There were gray, ancient dried fish and jellies and potatoes, sprouting wigs of grass. I avoided the cold locker of fresh meats, as we had no way to cook them. But shriveled clubs of sausage were perfect. I filled my sack and headed for my treat. Although the jars of fruits and vegetables were too big to carry, who was to say I could not help myself to them right there in the food cellar? I pulled out from a dusty corner my personal jar of peaches and syrup. The jar was almost as big around as myself. I unscrewed the lid and grabbed a peach. "What's that?" came Janina's voice at my shoulder. "What's it look like?" I stuffed the peach into my mouth. "I want one," she reached. I smacked her hand. "They're mine.
She balled her fists, leaned back, and screamed, "I'm hungry!" I grabbed another peach and stuffed it into her mouth. "Here!" I quick closed the jar and shoved it back just as the door opened and light flooded from above. Footsteps came partway down the stairway and stopped. A voice said, "Hello? Hello?" We crouched by the fruit jars, our cheeks bulging, peach juice streaming from our chins. "Hello?" At last, the footsteps went away, and the door closed. I pushed a crate under the window and climbed onto it. I shoved the stuffed sack, and then myself, through the bars. Even standing on the crate, Janina could not reach, so I had to help haul her out. Going back, lugging the sack over my shoulder, we stayed in the shadows and alleyways until the final dash, across the moonlight to the two-brick space and onto the other side. Another dash across the moonlight and back into the shadows. I headed for the orphanage. Dr. Korchak always left a window unlocked in the back. I opened it and dumped in half the contents of my sack. "What are you doing?" said Janina. "Feeding the orphans," I told her.
"You're supposed to feed us."
I was tired of her crabbing.
"I feed whoever I want to feed."
I slammed the window shut and headed home. 27. The next day I visited the boys. I knew I would find them in their new place, an alley behind a fire-gutted butcher shop. Before I got there, I could hear them. A whacking sound followed by cheers, and again, whack, then cheers. What was happening? I turned the corner. Big Henrik was holding Kuba upside down by his ankles, while Ferdy walloped Kuba's rump with a big bone, one of the many that were lying around. Ferdy stopped when he saw me. "Misha, come on, knock out your lice." Then I saw. Each time Ferdy walloped Kuba, a tiny blizzard, like salt, fell from Kuba's hair to the ground. With every blow, Kuba swung back and forth like the pendulum of a grandfather clock. When it was over, Kuba took the bone from Ferdy. He said, "Your turn, Mish." Just because he made me think of it, my head was itching more than ever. I could feel them crawling. I got down on all fours in front of Big Henrik. In a moment, I was hanging upside down, staring at his knees. "Get ready," said Kuba, and then I heard Ferdy's voice. "Wait! The book!" Ferdy stuffed a book down my pants, and the world shook as Kuba gave me the first wallop. Another voice came screaming, "Stop it! Stop it!" I twisted my head as best I could and saw Janina attacking Kuba, kicking him, punching him. Ferdy grabbed her, held her flailing. "I'm not hurting him," said Kuba. "Who is this?" said Ines. "This is Janina," I said as Kuba swung the bone. Then between wallops, "My sister!" By the time Kuba was done with me, Janina was yapping, "Me! Me!" She was heading for Big Henrik when Ines said, "You can't have a girl in a dress hanging upside down. She needs pants." I was the littlest, so I was elected. I took off my pants and gave them to Janina. I stuffed in the book, and upside down she went, and Kuba started walloping away. With each spank, she gave a yelp and a laugh. I had a thought. Maybe her angel will come out. This was my latest information from the boys on angels. Every person carries his or her own angel inside. When the rest of you is killed, the angel comes out and flies off to heaven. When I asked where heaven is, everyone had a different answer. Kuba said, "Russia." Oleg said, "Washington, America." Ina said, "You're all stupid. It's right here, Warsaw, the other side of the wall." As I watched Janina's little body jump with every spank, I couldn't imagine the angel inside her putting up with such a disturbance. I stared and stared, but nothing came out of her but yelps and laughs and lice. Kuba finally stopped. Janina was begging for more. She wouldn't give up my pants. Everyone laughed as I chased her around the rubble, the book bouncing in the pants like a load of horse flop. Suddenly the laughter stopped. I turned around. Four people were standing at the corner of the charred butcher shop. Everyone, even Janina, stopped and stared at them. They were two couples. The men were jackboots. Their buttons glinted like morning stars on their uniforms. The ladies were blonde-haired and wore little white hats and white gloves. All four of them were smiling. One of the jackboots was holding something. It was black. I was pretty sure it was a gun or a weapon. I wondered, "Why aren't we running?" And then I saw movement. Janina was walking toward them. I called out, "Janina, no!" Still smiling, the jackboot raised the weapon. He held it up to his eye, aiming it at her. "No!" I charged into the jackboot. He didn't budge. He reached down with his free hand and tossed me aside. He aimed again through the weapon at Janina. I heard click. Ina said, "Misha, stop. It's a camera. It takes pictures." I didn't know what he was talking about, but I backed off. The man with the camera aimed and clicked again. Beside me, Janina was doing a dance in the dust and smiling at the cameraman and saying, "Do it again, again." The couples were no longer just smiling. They were laughing out loud. The ladies were clinging to their men's arms to keep from falling over with laughter. Then one of the ladies pinched her nose, and the other pinched her nose, and they laughed louder, and the cameraman took more pictures. And the more they laughed and took pictures, the faster Janina danced and laughed. The dust she kicked up fell on their shoes. When the laughing died down, Janina stepped forward. She walked up to one of the ladies and said, "Do you live on the other side?" The lady did not answer. She just looked down and smiled. Then Janina reached out and touched the skirt of the lady's black and white checkerboard dress. The lady's smile vanished. She stepped back from Janina's reach. She looked down at the dust on her white shoes. She said something to the others. The smiles came back. The man taking pictures gave the camera to his lady. He motioned to Janina and me to stand side by side. He stood behind us. I could feel him smiling. He was close, but he never touched us. He said something to the lady. She aimed and clicked. "Maybe they'll shoot us now," I thought. But they didn't. They merely went away. As they were leaving, I called, "Aren't you going to shoot us?" They didn't respond. Enos hurried over. "Stupid gypsy!" He smacked the back of my head. "Learn to shut your stupid mouth!" I wished Uri were there. I preferred that he do the smacking. "Who were they?" said Ferdy. "Soldiers with their girlfriends," said Enos. "Out for a stroll in the ghetto. It's Sunday." "What's Sunday?" I said. Enos sneered. "The day they don't shoot you." Back on the streets, we saw other soldiers and girlfriends strolling about. The jackboot ladies wore white gloves. I couldn't stop staring at the gloves. They were whiter than snow. 28. Summer was flies. I thought of them as little birds. I remembered real birds. I remembered them singing as I lay in tall grass that smelled like carrots. Except for crows, birds did not come to the ghetto. There was no bread for them to eat, no seed. The crows that came did not sing. They squawked at each other. They seemed to say, "Over here, I found one," or, "Stay away, this is mine." There was always plenty for them to eat. They ate people, crows and flies. The wagons came in the morning. There had been a few horses left pulling the morning wagons, but the jackboots took them. So now, men became horses. When the wagon came to a body, it stopped, and the men went to the body. Not all bodies were dead. If a body had flies but no crow, it might still be alive, especially if it also had no newspaper over it. Sometimes crows pecked away the newspaper. When the men came to a body, the crows usually walked away. They walked 5 or 6 steps and turned and squawked at the men. One man took hands, one took feet, and they flopped the body onto the wagon. When the body flopped onto the pile, the whole wagon load of flies jumped into the air like lice from a walloper. Then they settled back down again, and a crow or two landed and went along for the ride. I used to think that if a body had no shoes or socks or coat, it was dead. but then I saw one such body climb out from under the pile on a wagon and walk away. The men had made a mistake, but you could count on crows. They never made a mistake. Some people died from sickness, some from hunger. There wasn't much I could do about the sickness, but hunger, that was where I came in. Feeding my family, and as much as possible Dr. Korchak's orphans, was what the world had made me for. All the parts, the stealing, the speed, the size, the rash stupidity, came together to make me the perfect smuggler. Janina followed me everywhere, my shadow. I went through the wall at night, and there she was, behind me, with a sack of her own. I never spoke to her. I pretended she wasn't there. We raided the Blue Camel Hotel. We raided the finest homes in Warsaw. We had many favorite kitchens. One was a special favorite because we always found pickled herring there. We must have felt very comfortable in that kitchen because we always turned the light on. One night we were sampling the herring when I heard Janina say, "Hello." I turned. A little boy was standing in the doorway. He wore pajamas. He was squinting in the light. The boy mumbled, "Who are you?" "I am Janina," she said. She suddenly seemed very grown up. She pointed to me. "This is Misha." The boy kneaded his fists in his eyes. "Are you Jews?" Janina laughed. "Ha ha! Jews? Oh no, we would never be Jews, not us. Ha ha!" She held out a piece of herring. "Want some fish?" The boy took the fish. And for the next hour, the three of us sat around the kitchen table, eating pickled herring and crackers and sugar cookies and milk. Drinking the milk, I thought about Dr. Korchak and the cow. We told the little boy we were playing a game called Whisper, so he wouldn't talk or laugh too loud. When we went out the window with our sacks full, the boy wanted to come with us. He cried. We told him we would come back again to visit him. But I knew we could never return to that house. At first, Janina's father did not know she went smuggling with me. He was always sleeping when we slipped quietly out of the room. I think Uncle Shepsel was often awake, but he never said anything. Then came the night we returned, sacks full, and found a lineup happening in the courtyard. Jackboots shouting, jackdogs snarling, blinding lights, filthy pigs of Abraham! We hid our sacks and sneaked behind the last row of people. We crept around until we found the Milgrams. We squeezed in between Uncle Shepsel and Mr. Milgram. I was shocked to see Mrs. Milgram standing in line, her head drooped on her chest. It was a very poor attention. Mr. Milgram's hand came down and squeezed Janina's ear. She squeaked. A nearby jackboot was shouting, "You smelly animals! You stink! Don't you ever wash?" I hoped Buffo wasn't there. This was his chance to get me. A man with a bullhorn was up front. "We know you are doing it. This is your first and last warning. You will be caught. Yes, yes. And when you are caught, you will be shot. If you are lucky. If you are not lucky, we will hang you. Either way, you are dead. One way is slower, more painful. Do you understand?" "Jawohl," I called out, using the jackboot word for yes. No one else spoke. This time, it was my ear that got squeezed. I looked up at Mr. Milgram. "What is he talking about?" He whispered, "You, smugglers, you must stop now." I did not stop, but I tried to make Janina stop. The next time she followed me into the night, I stopped in the courtyard and told her to go back. "No," she said. "Your father wants you to stop," I told her. "He'll be mad if they shoot you." "No, they'll hang you." "No. You get in my way. You're a filthy Jew. So are you. No." I could barely see her face in the darkness. I smacked her. This time I didn't give her a chance to smack me back. I pushed her to the ground. She came up flailing at me, and I hit her again and pushed her again and hit her again. She was crying. I left her there and walked away. She didn't come after me. She started yelling, "Misha's going to the wall! Misha smuggles! Misha smuggles!" Out in the street, a whistle blew. I ran back to her. I clamped my hand over her mouth. "Okay," I said. "Okay." I yanked her hair. Her yowl echoed in the courtyard. The whistle blew. We ran.
29. We made it to the wall and practically dove through the two-brick hole. But we didn't smuggle that night. I had the idea that as long as we didn't steal food, she was safe. As we passed houses, she kept pestering, "Let's go in there! There!" To distract her, I led her to the merry-go-round. It was deserted and dark. The people were in bed. A street light in the distance caught several horses leaping out of the shadows. There was no music, nothing going around. Yet, I could have sworn they were moving. I looked at the empty spot. I thought of the beautiful black horse, chopped off at the hooves. The three hooves were still there. I thought of the man who turned blue. We went to the far side, away from the light. We each climbed onto a horse. We pretended we were galloping, racing. Janina kept shouting, "I win!" After a while, she came over to my horse and climbed on behind me. She put her arms around my waist. Her chin jutted into my back. "Faster! Faster!" When I got tired of this, I said, "Do you want to see an angel?" "What's an angel?" she said. "I'll show you." We climbed down from the horse and I took her to the cemetery. The moon was going in and out of clouds. The night sky looked like smoking rubble. It took a while, but I finally found it. It towered above us. The wings blotted out much of the sky. "There," I said. She gazed up, her mouth open. "Angel?" "It's not a real one," I told her. "It's only made of stone. It's what real ones would look like if you could see them." "Why can't we see them?" "Because they hide inside people. There's one inside of you."
"Inside me?"
I clamped my hand over her mouth.
"Everybody has an angel hiding inside. When you die, your angel comes out."
"You can die, but not your angel."
"Your angel never dies."
She looked up at the great wings. "It's too big to fit inside me."
"When it's inside you, it's little," I told her. "When it comes out, it grows like a balloon."
My own mouth was never shy about adding details that the boys had overlooked. She felt herself all over. She stuck her fingers in her ears, in her nostrils.
"I don't feel it."
She reached up and pulled my mouth open and tried to peer inside. "I don't see yours." She stomped her foot. "I want to see one."
"You can't," I told her.
But I didn't exactly believe that. I believed that sooner or later I would catch a glimpse of one coming out of a freshly dead body or just hanging around, reluctant to leave. They don't live here. They live in heaven.
"Where's that?"
"I don't know," I said. "Ina says it's right here, on this side of the wall. But I never saw an angel over here." "Kuba says it's in Russia. Oleg says Washington, America."
"What's Washington, America?"
"Ina says it's a place with no wall and no lice and lots of potatoes." Janina reached out and touched the stone foot. Then she smacked it.
"I don't like you," she said.
We went home. I hoped we wouldn't walk into a lineup again. We didn't. But there was something else. Creeping along the shadows toward home, we saw an orange glow beyond a corner and heard a strange sound like a fierce gust of wind. We sneaked up to the corner for a peek.
I couldn't believe what I saw. A man was spouting fire.
The fire came gushing out of a hose like burning horse water and down into a sewer hole in the street.
"Enos, Ferdy, Oleg."
We ran home. I couldn't sleep. At sunrise, Janina was snoring. I raced to the butcher shop ruins. They were there, all of them. I told them what I saw. Ferdy blew a smoke ring. Oleg said, "Flamethrower." Ina said, "They're cracking down." Kuba said, "Your sewer rat should come over the wall with me. The sewer stinks."
"They can't watch all the manholes," said Enos.
"And the flamethrower only reaches 20 meters.
"It's gorgeous," I said.
They all stared at me. I would have stared at myself if I could. I don't know where I got that word. But it was true. When I saw the brilliant orange flame in the night, I saw better than ever before how gray was the world I lived in. 30. I could not stop Janina from following me, and we couldn't eat merry-go-round horses and stone angels, so soon we were stealing food again. And then something happened.
and I was glad it did. The day was hot, steamy. Janine and I were down near the entrance to the cemetery on Genscher Street. We were watching the long parade of body wagons lined up at the gate. The wagons were pulled by men horses. The bodies were in heaps. The number of them was much higher than I could count at the time. A peppery cloud of flies hovered over the flopped arms and legs. The air buzzed. Only a few living people came with the wagons. Except for the rags they wore and the fact that they were standing, they looked like the bodies. One old woman held onto an ankle jutting out from a heap. A flop at the gate collected money. Only the dead got into the cemetery for free. We heard a commotion. We followed the noise to an intersection of streets. There were jackboots and flops and young boys. One of the flops was Buffo. People were watching. I think they did not want to watch, but jackboots were pointing guns at them. There was also, in the middle of the square, a pile of onions. I could smell them. A jackboot was pulling open the jackets of the boys, and the onions were tumbling out. The boys all seemed to have the same problem. They were hunchbacks. Only the humps in their backs were made of onions. When all the humps were emptied out, the jackboot called to the people, "We tell you, do not smuggle! We tell you!" And the jackboots and flops began beating the boys with their clubs, and the boys' hats flew, and they were screaming and falling and bleeding among the onions, and the people watched and did not move. I pulled Janina away. "See?" I said. I squeezed her arm. I shook her. "See what happens when you steal food? Do you want that to happen to you?" She yelled into my face, "I hate you!" She broke loose and ran off. Good, I thought. She finally learned her lesson. And for the rest of that day, I thought, the pest is gone. I wanted to make sure, so I told her father. I told him she had been following me, smuggling with me. I told him I could not make her stop. I could not keep her safe. She stood beside me, gaping. Her father's face turned hard and ugly. I thought he would smack her. But he didn't even touch her. He bent down until his face was right in front of hers, like a jackboot in a lineup. He looked at her as if she were a stranger. He said one word. "No." Her lip pouted out and quivered. Her great eyes watered. She ran to the mattress and threw herself onto it and huddled into her mother. When I went out that night, she stayed put. It was getting harder to creep down the stairs in the dark now, as people were sleeping there. More and more people were being trucked into the ghetto. People were living in stairwells and bathrooms and cellars and roofs. I felt my way through the sleeping bodies and waited in the shadows of the courtyard. No one came down after me. At every corner along the way to the two-brick hole, I stopped and looked back. No one followed. I wriggled through the hole and thought, I'm free. The next day, back inside the wall, I was sitting on a curb in the street. I was watching a little girl on the opposite curb lunching on the snot pouring from her nose when I heard a familiar cry, "Fat man! Fat man!" I ran. Sure enough, there was Janina in the middle of the street, squatting on her haunches, hurling her voice, thumbing her nose at Buffo, taunting him in perfect imitation of me. I saw the gleam in Buffo's eyes as he came clumping after her, spewing flecks of mint, his massive belly bouncing. Janina screamed and laughed and ran. I fell in beside her, and when we turned a corner, I shoved her into an alley, and when Buffo came around, I threw stones at him, and I saw his eyes darting about for her and his fingers curling. I couldn't stand the thought of him pulling her into the death balloon of his belly. I remembered Cuba and the funeral in the cemetery. I turned my back on Buffo and pulled down my pants and gave him a moon. I heard his roar, and I had to run while pulling up my pants. When I finally appeared back in the courtyard, Janina could not stop laughing. I hated her mimicking me in everything I did. All my talents were useless with her. I could not escape her any more than I could outrun my shadow. From that day on, I stopped tormenting Buffo, only to give her one less part of me to copy. That night I raided two homes on the other side, but got only a few sprouting potatoes and a can of sardines. Once again, Janina had stayed behind. I dropped a potato through the open back window of the orphanage and returned to the room, stumbling over sleeping bodies on the stairway. Lying down in the blackness of the room, I reached out to touch Janina. I felt nothing. I groped around. She wasn't there. I sat up. I had a thought, but I couldn't believe it. I sat up until I heard the door squeak open. I lay down. I felt her step over me to her place on the floor. I went to sleep. I had put two potatoes and the sardines on the table when I came in that night. In the morning, there were three potatoes more, plus a pancake. It went that way night after night, through the wall, into heaven, thanks to Ines, that's what we were calling the other side of the wall, raiding kitchens, cellars, trash cans, separately. Like a good little girl, Janina was obeying her father. She did not go with me. She went on her own. Sometimes we passed each other in the shadows. Once we found ourselves spinning around the revolving door of the Blue Camel Hotel at the same time. We pretended not to see each other. One time we almost bumped heads reaching into the same garbage can. In the mornings, there on the table, would be our loot. She mixed hers with mine. Every morning, Mr. Milgram thanked me for the food. He never thanked Janina, as he believed she never left the room all night. She never claimed credit. To stop the smugglers, the jackboots sent more patrols and more dogs into the ghetto at night. There were gunshots, screams, the orange glow of flamethrowers. But I wasn't afraid. There was still the darkness, and Bufo seemed to appear only in daylight. One day we were both very sleepy. It had been harder than usual to find food in heaven the night before, and day was coming by the time we both made it back to the room. We slept for a while and went outside together. We played pick-up sticks in the dust of the courtyard, and then went wandering about the streets. I was, as always, on the alert for signs of Bufo, or the mystery cow, but in time the buzzing of the flies and the warmth of the day took the edge from my attention and made me drowsy. I wobbled into an alleyway and laid myself down. Janina, of course, did the same. Within moments, I was sleeping. Next thing I knew, I jerked awake. Janina was screaming. A barefoot clump of rags was slouching off down the alley. Janina was reaching for her shoe on the ground. "He tried to steal my shoe," she whined. I laughed. "He thought you were dead," she yelled after the clump. "I'm not dead!" As she put her shoe back on, she was staring at me. "What's that?" she said. She was pointing to something. I looked. It was a brown seed with a spray of white fluff coming out of it. It was clinging to my shirt. And suddenly, the word for it was on my tongue. A word I didn't even know I knew. "Milkweed," I said. She plucked it from my shirt. She held it by the seed up to the light. She dusted her nose with it and giggled. She brushed the fluff across her cheek, closing her eyes. She stood on tiptoes and held it as high as she could and let it go. It sailed toward the sky. "That's my angel," she said. Then they were all around us. Milkweed puffs, flying. I picked one from her hair. I pointed. "Look!" A milkweed plant was growing by a heap of rubble. It was thrilling just to see a plant, a spot of green in the ghetto desert. The bird-shaped pods had burst and the puffs were spilling out, flying off. I cracked a pod from the stem and blew into the silk-lined hollow, sending the remaining puffs sailing, a snowy shower rising, vanishing into the clouds. 31. Winter. A dead leaf skittered in the moonlight as I wriggled my way through the two-brick hole to the other side. I took off my armband. I knew Janina was somewhere behind me. On this bitterly cold night, the streets of Warsaw were almost as deserted as those of the ghetto. But the Blue Camel Hotel was always bright and warm. As I sailed through the revolving door, I caught a glimpse of red hair in the lobby. I went around again and stopped inside. It was Uri. He was dressed in fine clothes, white shirt, black trousers, shoes. I watched him for a moment. He was emptying ashtrays into a wheeled trash can that he pushed around the lobby. I called out, "Uri!" He didn't hear me. He was heading for a hallway at the back of the lobby. "Uri!" I ran after him. When I got to the hallway, he was gone. I went down the hallway, peeking into dark rooms. Suddenly, I was off my feet and flying into one of them. The door slammed shut. I couldn't see a thing, but I knew. It was Uri holding me and whispering into my ear, "What are you doing here?" "I saw you. Ow!" He was squeezing my arm. "I called you. Didn't you see me? What are you doing here?" He shook me. "Never mind what I'm doing here. I work in the laundry. If I see you in here again, I'll tell them to shoot you. My name is not Uri here. You never, never call me that." His hand squeezed my neck. His breath was in my face. "Do you hear?" I nodded, choking. "Never come in here again. Get out. Now." The door opened, and I was flung into the bright hallway. Outside, on the street, I expected to see Janina. She was usually within sight, following me but pretending she wasn't. I didn't see her. Something inside me said, "Good." Something else said, "I don't like this." I disappeared into my usual shadows and alleyways. I did not seek out new places on this night. I went to familiar, reliable garbage cans and a few unguarded home pantries, places we both knew well. I kept expecting to bump into her. I kept glancing around. She wasn't there. The moon, as always, had moved halfway across the sky by the time I was done with my shopping. It was full on this night, my least favorite kind of moon. Normally, I dashed for the wall and practically dove through the hole. This time, I stopped at the wall and waited, crouching in the shadow. I could not stay long. The wall was patrolled. Nothing but the patrols moved in Warsaw at this time of night. I kept waiting, hoping to see a tiny fragment of shadow break away and come running to the wall, to me. Somewhere on the other side of the wall, a dog barked, a whistle blew. I thought of the other boys. I hoped they were safe. Something moved, down along the wall, a glint of silver in the moonlight. A patrol was coming. I stuffed my sack through the hole, then myself. A minute later, I found her. She was near a street corner, standing still, not even trying to hide herself, her sack of food dumped on the ground beside her. I did not want to call out. I approached her quietly from behind. She did not move. She seemed to be looking at something. She was looking up. And then I saw. A body was hanging from the crossbar of a streetlight whose lamp had long since stopped shining. It was hanging by the neck. I wondered why the hanging body had stopped her. It was not the first she had seen. Death was as familiar to us as life. Even though still breathing, walking, they looked as if they were waiting for someone to tell them they were dead. So why was my heart hammering my chest? Because the body, I could see now as I stopped beside her, had one arm. It was a boy. It was Oleg. A sign was hanging across his chest. In the moonlight, it was easy to see the words, but I could not read. Flat on the ground, his shadow was hanging too. 32. I was a smuggler. The next morning, Ines told me what the sign said. "They'll hang us all," he said. "Not me," I said. "They can't catch me." "Not me," said Janina. "They can't catch me." Ines laughed. We sat on rocks at the ruins of the butcher shop. No one said anything. Ferdy smoked. Kuba stared at the dust. For once he had nothing funny to say. Big Henrik bawled. He took off his shoes and pounded the frozen earth with them. He threw away the shoes and bawled some more. I said, "I saw Uri." No one looked up. Janina spat in the dirt. "I hate your angels." The next day, the first snow flurries came. Children held their faces to the sky, trying to catch flakes on their tongues. I visited the orphanage. Dr. Korchak was teaching the children a song. When he saw me, he said, "Misha, come join us. Sing with us." I stood in the middle of the children and sang the words. After the singing, we were given a cabbage cake and a spoonful of fat. I never saw Dr. Korchak eat. Everyone had shoes. When I left, I walked about the ghetto singing my song in the snowflakes. I saw a boy eating a newspaper. A voice called, "Misha Pilsudski! Misha Milgram!" I recognized the voice, but I couldn't believe my ears. I turned. It was Uncle Shepsel. Since the day the Jews paraded into the ghetto, I had not seen Uncle Shepsel outside the room, except for lineups. He was smiling, showing the world his brown teeth. His hand came down on my shoulder. "Misha! Misha! Is it not a beautiful day?" I looked around. It seemed like any other day to me. Gray. Up the street, a man was banging his head against a stone wall. But I was an agreeable fellow. "Yes," I said. "Yes, yes." He looked around. He closed his eyes and took a deep breath and stood like that for a while. I thought he had gone to sleep. The head of the man up the street was red, but he was still banging. Uncle Shepsel opened his eyes and smiled down at me. I had seen the same smile in the room lately, as he read the book that had changed him from a Jew to a Lutheran. He removed my cap and mussed my hair. Lice eggs flew like baby snowflakes. He replaced my cap. He nodded dreamily. Suddenly his expression changed. He seemed confused. He looked hard into my face and did not seem to know me. "You go. Every night you go," he said. "Why do you come back?" I did not have an answer. Maybe he found it in my face. For after a while he turned and walked off. Up the street, the man was on the ground. My feet led me back to the room. Mrs. Milgram was lying on the mattress as usual, facing the wall. She looked the same in every way, and yet I knew at once that she was dead. Mr. Milgram was sitting on the edge of the mattress. Janina was in his lap. Her face was in his chest, and she was crying. Her father rocked her back and forth. When he looked at me, his eyes were shining. Ever since Mr. Milgram had made me a member of the family, I had wanted to call Mrs. Milgram mother. I did so once, and she replied, "I am not your mother." I was confused. By the time I decided to try again, she had turned her back on the room for good. And now she was dead. And Mr. Milgram's eyes were making me sad. I put my hand on his shoulder, as Dr. Korchak had often done to me. I looked into his shining eyes, and I said, "Tata." He took me onto his lap next to Janina, and now I was being rocked back and forth, too. I tried to cry like my sister, but I was too busy looking for Mrs. Milgram's angel. We sat up all night with the body of Mrs. Milgram, except for Uncle Shepsel, who went to sleep when he returned to the room. In the morning, Mr. Milgram left and came back with the undertaker. He gave the undertaker a small bottle of white pills. He said he had been saving them for this day. He reached under the mattress and pulled out a little black bowl-shaped piece of cloth. I wondered what it was. He put it on his head. It was a hat. The undertaker and his two helpers carried Mrs. Milgram down to the courtyard, where a cart was waiting. Mrs. Milgram was laid in the cart and covered with a ragged scrap of cabbage-colored wool that had once been a blanket. The undertaker led the way out of the courtyard. Then came the helpers pulling the cart. Then came the three of us. Uncle Shepsel stayed back in the room. We were the smallest parade ever. There were many bodies along the way. I was surprised that we were not picking up some of them. But I was pleased also, because I did not want to see Mrs. Milgram wind up on the bottom of a heap. I had never been so slow before. Even when I was not fleeing, I was running, or at least walking fast. Everything I did was fast. I forced myself to keep pace with Mr. Milgram and Janina. He held my hand. I kept telling myself, "My mother is dead in the cart. I must not go faster than her." We passed the orphanage. Dr. Korchak stood in the doorway. He put his hands together and closed his eyes and said words. I could not hear them, but I could see them puff from his mouth in the winter air. Many women passed us, going the other way. They all wore coats and wraps of fox and other furs. They looked very sad. Some were crying. They had been ordered to turn in all furs at Stovky Station. A man went marching past us in the street. He had no shirt or coat on, no shoes or rags on his feet. He made peeping sounds from a silver pipe that he held to his mouth. He waved the pipe in the air and called out, "Children, children, come with me. We go to the Candy Mountain. Follow me, follow me." At the gate to the cemetery on Gansha Street, Mr. Milgram gave the guard a bottle of pills, and we were let in. We went to an empty plot of ground. The undertaker's helpers found shovels and dug a hole. A crow sat nearby on a tilting tombstone. It stared at me. I thought it spoke to me. In its croaky voice, it said the same thing over and over. I could not understand. I left Mrs. Milgram's side and walked toward the crow. "What?" I called. The crow spoke one last time and flew off. As they were laying Mrs. Milgram in her grave, the first bomb fell on the other side of the wall. I felt it in my feet. I looked up. It was raining bombs. The ground was trembling as if all the dead had decided to leave their graves at once. The undertaker and his helpers and the cemetery guards all ran. Mr. Milgram just stood there, staring into the hole. A bomb exploded several blocks away on our side of the wall. Then more came. Mr. Milgram looked at us. "Children," he said. He lifted each of us and lowered us into the hole with Mrs. Milgram. "Cover your eyes." We curled around each other on the scrap of wool at the feet of Mrs. Milgram. The earth was thumping like a heart. When I peeked upward, I saw Mr. Milgram sitting on the edge of the grave hole, his feet dangling toward us. Janina pulled something from her pocket. It was a milkweed pod. She must have plucked it from the plant in the alley. It looked empty. She blew into it. Three or four puffs rose into the air. They sailed up and out of the grave, past Mr. Milgram, and into the rectangle of gray sky and the black falling teardrops of the bombs. 33. When the bombing stopped, we returned home to Uncle Shepsel shouting in the courtyard, "It's the Russians! We're saved!" He danced into the street. "We're saved!" Uncle Shepsel was the only one dancing. Upstairs we found other people in our room. With people being trucked into the ghetto every day, this was happening everywhere. Now it was happening to us. Janina snapped, "You're in our house!" Everyone stared, but no one said anything. Mr. Milgram pushed his pill cabinet and the table to one side of the room. To the people, he said, "You can have the mattress." I went to find the boys. Enos was standing on top of the butcher shop rubble. He was laughing. The others were staring at him. "What's funny?" I said. "What's funny?" He laughed some more. "Everything. They herd us in here like animals. They build a wall around us. They starve us. They freeze us. They beat us. They shoot us. They hang us. They set us on fire. And then, guess what?" He reached down to Big Henrik and rapped him on the head. "Guess what?"
"What?"
said Big Henrik.
"I'll tell you what."
Ina started laughing again.
"The Russians come along and say, 'That's not enough. You Nazis are too easy on them. So we're going to bomb them.' And that's what they do."
He threw out his arms.
"They bomb us."
He looked at us all.
"You don't think that's the funniest thing you ever heard of?"
No one laughed. Not even Kuba. Funny or not, the bombs kept falling, and the winter was cold, and the people were hungry. Orphans by the thousands roamed the streets in their rags and boils, slumped in doorways, begging for food, clothing, anything. There was nothing to give them. So they starved and froze and died in the snow, their arms frozen outward, still begging. The children who lived were all scraps and eyes. This was the ghetto, where children grew down instead of up. I couldn't believe there had been a time when the boys and I had wrestled in piles of food. One day Janina and I heard a commotion in the courtyard. We looked down from the window. A jackboot and his girlfriend were standing on the entrance. The man had a bag. He was pulling pieces of bread from the bag and tossing them onto the snow. Every time he tossed a piece, 10 people pounced on it. The soldier and his girlfriend laughed. They called other couples to come and watch and laugh with them. I saw one girlfriend who did not laugh. If only lice were food. Every morning we awoke with eyelashes gunked with lice. They made a pop and squirted red when we squeezed them between thumb and fingernail. Every day the man with the silver pipe marched up and down the streets. "Come to the Candy Mountain!" Once, I saw a boy stagger after him, but the piper was going too fast. With the new people in the room, Janina and I could no longer leave our smuggled food on the table. When we returned each night, we slipped food into the coat pockets of Mr. Milgram and Uncle Shepsel as they slept. There were 7 new people. 5 were adults, 2 were little twin boys. The adults never spoke to Uncle Shepsel or Mr. Milgram, but the twin boys came to Janina and me when we were playing pick-up sticks. They tried to play, but they were too little to do it right. They made Janina laugh. She began to leave a piece of potato or onion under their noses at night. There was even less food now since the bombing by the Russians. It had gone on for many days. Most of the bombs had fallen on heaven. The clang of the trolleys was gone. The colors were gone, except for the glowing blue line of the camel. We smuggled every night. On the way over, Janina stayed far behind. Sometimes I turned quickly to catch sight of her. But there were only shadows. It was her game. Then we had an unexpected holiday. As I was nearing the hole in the wall one night, I heard a sound. I looked. There was something on the ground. I picked it up. It was a cabbage, a firm, fine one. Suddenly, more things were falling at my feet. Sausages and potatoes. By now, Janina was with me, scooping them up. "Somebody is throwing food over the wall," I said in wonder. We stood there, looking up, but nothing else came down. We ran home with the food, giggling all the way. The next night, we were ready as the food came flying over the wall again. This happened night after night. Tins of sardines and herring, fruits and babkas of all flavors. More than anything, we loved seeing the astonished faces of Mr. Milgram and Uncle Shepsel when we returned with our nightly feast. And then, just as suddenly, the flying food stopped. We were back on our own. We always met on the other side. If she didn't find me searching for food, she would be waiting for me at the 2-brick hole. We always came back through the wall together, me first, then her, ever since the night we found Oleg. Until the night I couldn't fit back through the hole. First, I took off my coat and stuffed it through the hole. I still couldn't get through. I panicked. I tore off my pants and jammed myself into the hole and didn't stop until I was through. I reached back for my pants and redressed myself. But Janina was already laughing so hard her cabbages were rolling across the ground. The next day at the butcher shop, I found a good bone among the charred bricks and handed it to Big Henrik and said, "Beat me." Big Henrik was confused. I knew he wouldn't understand. "I'm getting too big," I said to Ines. I lay on the ground on my back. I raised the bottoms of my feet to Big Henrik. "Beat my feet," I told him. "I need to stop growing." Ines laughed. "Beat him," he said. "If you don't, I will." Big Henrik's first wallop sent me skidding over the frozen ground like a sled on ice. Everyone laughed. Ines pushed against my shoulders to keep me from sliding. He told Big Henrik to beat away. Big Henrik was beating away on the soles of my feet when I heard the moo. We all heard it. I couldn't believe it. All along, I had been on the lookout for the cow. I so wanted to please Dr. Korchak. And now, here it was, plain to hear as a flop's whistle. But it didn't sound right. It was nearby. We ran to the street, to a courtyard. There it was, galloping across a balcony, a flaming, fiery cow, screaming while a jackboot behind it laughed, and the flamethrower retched more fire until the cow plunged through the railing and sailed through the air, flames flapping like wings to the ground. One person ran across the courtyard to the burning cow, and then it was mobbed.
34. "This year you will celebrate with us," said Mr. Milgram. He meant the holiday called Hanukkah. It was the first Jewish word I had learned. He had wanted to include me the year before, but Mrs. Milgram would not allow it. "No," she had said, groaning from her mattress. "He is not a Jew. I am not his mother." She is not herself,
Mr. Milgram had said. Still, I was not allowed. For 8 nights I had sat in a corner and watched.